versus First Unum Life Insurance Company. Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dabowski. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Leah Pistilli. We are seeking reversal of the judgment of the court below because the judgment failed to comport with four important precedents from this court: Halo versus Yale Health Plan, McCauley versus Unum, Kryzik versus Cigna, and Doe versus Menifee, which were all cited in our briefs, and the Doe case actually cited Kryzik as well. In this court's Halo decision, the court emphasized the need for strict compliance with the ERISA claim regulations. And subsequent to the issuance of that ruling, the Department of Labor amended their ERISA claim regulations to provide that strict compliance was mandatory. So the 10th Circuit case cited by defendant appellee would not be applicable in this situation. First Unum failed to comply with the regulations in several respects. The first was their issuance of a tardy decision without providing special circumstances that would justify their tardiness. The second was their reliance on biased medical consultants. Dr. Grattan has been cited 44 times in a Lexis search as providing opinions for insurance companies and zero times for providing opinions for claimants. And the third was the failure of First Unum to engage with the rebuttal that Ms. Pistilli submitted after she was provided with reports from Dr. Grattan and the Unum psychologist.
And if I may ask for clarification, failure to provide rebuttal, do you mean that failure to have your client examined by an independent, like an actual examination as opposed to an independent reviewer? I'm trying to understand.
No. What I'm trying to convey is that Unum failed to engage with the rebuttal that was submitted. There were reports from Drs. Patel and from Dr. Van Gorp. And you've gone through the record in this case. You can see how meticulously First Unum documents everything that they do and everything that they considered. And there is nothing in the record after the submission of that rebuttal prior to the issuance of a final decision.
And in terms of the special circumstances, it was my understanding that the district court found that the 45, I assume you're referring to the 45-day limit, that there was good reason to seek that extension because there were records requested from your client which had not been produced.
The records that were requested were psychiatric records. Ms. Pistilli was not claiming any psychiatric basis for her disability. There was no reference in either the initial denial or the final denial that Unum was deprived of that evidence and couldn't reach a decision. It was just a pure delaying tactic by First Unum.
I also understood from your adversary's papers, and I want to be able to address this, that they thought that an extension was warranted because there were voluminous new records submitted for the first time on appeal. Why should that not be permissible as special circumstances?
Because that's what's expected in these ERISA benefit claims. And
let me pursue that a little more.
Certainly.
I mean, if the volume of records and the grounds urged in those records or supported by those records is somewhat different from what was reviewed, was urged at the first level, why wouldn't it be permissible to say, you know, we want to review these thoroughly. We need more than the 45 days to do it. Why would that not be a permissible decision by the administrator?
First, HALO and the regulations require strict compliance. Just as Ms. Pistilli had to meet the 180-day deadline to submit her appeal. Unum had to meet the 45-day deadline to respond. Second.
I may not have been clear. What I'm saying is when the new records suggest a different argument, I mean, I understand where you knew what the argument was below. You've got 45 days to review it. But when now new records almost in support of a different argument, this is what I understand your adversary to be urging. Why isn't that enough to support an extension?
I was just about to get to that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So the new records were merely corroborative. So for instance, Dr. Spica questioned the initial neuropsychological report performed by Dr. Tabia. So Ms. Pistilli got a second neuropsychological report from Dr. Van Gorp, which did meet validity standards and did make findings of cognitive impairment, which were nearly identical to the earlier ones. There was more evidence provided of neurological issues, except they were provided by doctors who had greater expertise. The district court opinion refers to Dr. Patel as a neuroradiologist. He got the wrong Dr. Roshini Patel. The Roshini Patel who reported in this case is an expert on head trauma. And her report was more thorough and more detailed. It's just a matter of degree. It wasn't a matter of difference. And as the Cogdell decision pointed out earlier this year, and the Rappaport decision from the Southern District of New York pointed out, these are ordinary things that happen in ERISA benefit claim appeals. So there is no reason to seek a delay. They are not special circumstances. Special circumstances have to be case specific and relate to circumstances that were outside of the control of the plan.
The Tenth Circuit in Holmes, though, said that the plan administrator has sole discretion to determine whether special circumstances exist requiring an extension of the deadline. At the very least, you're asking us to depart from that, I assume.
First of all, Holmes is inconsistent with HALO. And secondly, that ruling eviscerates the whole purpose of the regulation. If the insurance company has sole discretion to run the clock as long as they wish, the point is to get a prompt claim determination. And that's what Ms. Pistilli did not receive. And the consequences of that would be de novo review.
Judge Hellerstein, though, specifically found that this was not a running the clock situation. He found that this was, in fact, an example of diligent review of the records, and on that ground thought that it was not an abuse of the administrator's discretion to take an extra 45 days.
It was not a diligent review. The review was...
So, are you saying the district court committed clear error in saying that it found diligence?
The district court committed clear error, and there was no basis for that finding. Unum could easily have gotten the same two reports well within 45 days. Most of Dr. Gratton's report is just a recital of the evidence. And the report from the other neuropsychologist was just an unfounded attack on Dr. Van Gorp. There was nothing new that they did. Perhaps if Unum had said, you know, we need to do an examination here and we're going to need a little bit of extra time because we need to schedule the examination, we'd have a different argument. But that's not what took place here. Unum ran the clock. The next point, and I see I'm running out of time, but the next point is this court's McCauley case said that Unum's conflict of interest has to be taken into consideration. That was a follow-on from MetLife versus Glenn. And Judge Hellerstein's opinion says absolutely nothing about Unum's conflict of interest, which is an important consideration that Glenn commands has to be taken into consideration in every case. With respect to the Kryzik case, what this court found in the Kryzik case basically was a concept that comes out of Social Security disability case law, that it's improper to subject a claimant to a sit and squirm test. Dr. Hellerstein found that Ms. Pistilli was credible in her testimony, but then claimed just contrary to the evidence in the transcript, that she didn't display any symptoms. Throughout the transcript, she complained that she was experiencing a migraine headache with pain in her eye. She rated the severity at a level of 7 out of 10. She asked for a break. She was clearly symptomatic. And she told Judge Hellerstein that she just wanted to try and power through because she knew she couldn't come back. So the credibility finding is the credibility finding. And Judge Hellerstein acknowledged that if the symptoms were real, then they would preclude her from working.
Am I correctly understanding the district court's conclusion that he found that she was disabled?
Yes.
He didn't think that it was caused by the accident.
And that's my final point.
Oh, okay.
Because that goes further than what Unum did. Unum based their denial solely on Ms. Pastilli's inability or her claimed ability to perform the duties of her job. They did not say this was a pre-existing condition exclusion. And as pointed out to Judge Hellerstein in the trial proceeding, Ms. Pastilli was in decent health the day before the car accident. She was working. She had just started a new job at Davis Polk. She was on track to become a partner. And then she had this accident, and all of a sudden, her world just was completely disrupted after that. None of that makes any sense. And the only intervening event was the car accident. But the policy doesn't even require the basis that Judge Hellerstein applied for denying the claim. The record shows that Unum just simply made a decision of not disabled enough.
Let me assume you're right. Your adversary will tell us if he views it otherwise, that the decision by the administrator was she's not disabled. And Judge Hellerstein affirms on the ground that she's disabled, but it wasn't caused by the accident. So we have the same conclusion, but two different routes. What's the error there? Is the error by the district court? Where's the error that we would identify?
The error is by the district court. It's a post hoc justification. The whole point of these ERISA claims is that both 29 USC section 1133 and 29 CFR section 2560.503-1 say the insurance company is obligated to set forth all of the reasons that they're denying the claim so that the insured has a fair opportunity to appeal. Judge Hellerstein came out of left field and came up with a new reason that we never had an opportunity to rebut.
And if the standard we apply is arbitrary and capricious, how does that relate to your argument? I mean, I understand if it's de novo, but if it's arbitrary and capricious standard.
Well, there, I'm going to go back to McCauley, that McCauley says that the insurance company's conflict of interest has to be taken into consideration. And there was no consideration of that. Judge Hellerstein just basically said, well, you know, Unum had a bunch of doctors here and they all gave opinions that he finds reasonable, even though none of those doctors examined Ms. Pastilli, and none of the opinions that they gave were consistent with the clinical examination findings and the objective test results. So
the objective test results? I thought the objective test results were that there was no difference between, for example, the MRI taken approximately three years prior to the accident and the MRI taken shortly after the accident.
There's some dispute over that. Dr. Patel did find that the MRIs were different, but even putting that aside, we have the clinical evidence from the five neurologists who examined Ms. Pastilli. We have the Romberg test. We have the Tinel sign. We have vision testing, which showed impaired vision and a convergence impairment. We have the neuropsychological testing, which confirmed cognitive impairment. All of those are objective tests. And none of Unum's doctors issued opinions that took those tests into consideration.
I do want to hear from First Union about ideology, but I want to hear your view. Is it your view that Judge Hellerstein's consideration of the cause of the disability in and of itself is a basis to remand?
Yes.
That alone. If we agree with you on that, is it necessary to reach the first point, the standard of review, given the possible violation of the ERISA regulations? I mean, Judge Hellerstein might, on remand, side with you.
Your Honor, that's an excellent question. I think that the issue doesn't have to be resolved, but I think the issue should be resolved because that would give Judge Hellerstein direction on remand. Thank you.
Thank you. You actually were about 7 minutes over your argument time, but you reserved your 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Patrick Bagos from Robinson & Cole for the appellee First Unum Life Insurance Company. If I may, I'll just start by saying that Judge Hellerstein had extensive review of the administrative record, took plaintiff's testimony, which he found good cause to receive, and then made extensive findings of fact, which supported the conclusions that he reached, which were that arbitrary and capricious standard of review was appropriate, that First Unum's determination was reasonable and supported by substantial evidence, and that even if the review was to be de novo, that First Unum's determination was correct. And if I may, I'm going to address...
Why don't you start with, to the extent those were the judge's findings, is there an inconsistency? Am I correct that First Unum's finding was she wasn't disabled and therefore no benefits?
First Unum's finding is that she wasn't disabled as a result of the motor vehicle accident.
Is that what they said? I mean, because that suggests that they made a causation finding and your adversary saying, no, they didn't.
It's absolutely true that they made a causation finding.
Help
so
me
let
out.
Me, first of all, the plan here requires submission of proof of the cause of disability. That's undisputed. Secondly, First Unum made clear in the administrative record that when it started the review, it was looking at a pre-existing condition because the disability claim started within less than a year after Ms. Pastilli was covered. And it concluded early on, it didn't need to pursue that pre-existing condition investigation because she was claiming that she was disabled as a result of the accident. When you look at what the doctors said, both plaintiff's doctors and First Unum's doctors, they all referred to the question whether the minor motor vehicle accident was capable of causing the injuries and the symptoms that the plaintiff was complaining of. And when you look at the decision letter, so the letter denying benefits, which is at pages 1832 to 40 of the record, First Unum started out by saying, you went out of work on July 9th, 2022, due to injuries sustained in a motor vehicle accident on July 8th, 2022. And then its conclusion was, and I'm skipping a few words here, our review concludes that the available information, including the severity of the MVA, do not support that you have been unable to perform the demands of your occupation. And if you look at the appeal decision, which is at page 2757 and subsequent, it starts, the records available indicated that your client claimed disability from our occupation due to traumatic brain injury and post-concussion symptoms following a minor motor vehicle accident. And then the final conclusion, based on information currently available to us, we have determined your client is not disabled due to her reported acute injuries from the accident or any other conditions that were assessed in the available medical records. And even
that
if you look at-
suggests that she's not disabled-
As a result of the-
At that time.
As a result of the accident.
No. And or any other causes. You just read it. That would suggest to a reader, this is not a disabled person. And that, I understand that that's the finding and you're arguing it's well supported in the record. But we have Judge Hellerstein saying she is disabled, just not because of the accident. And I'm concerned about whether we have a discrepancy here.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, Judge Hellerstein didn't say in his findings of fact and conclusions of law that Ms. Pastilli was disabled. Plaintiff here is relying on comments that interpretation of comments that Judge Hellerstein made from the bench after her testimony. There's nothing in the findings of fact and conclusions of law that say Ms. Pastilli is disabled, however, the disability wasn't caused by the motor vehicle accident.
It sounds like that's what he's saying, though. The decision says the objective evidence does not support her claim that because of the accident, she no longer can perform the duties of a corporate finance attorney. Pastilli claims that she is disabled because of a car accident, but issues of severe headaches have plagued her for long before this accident. That seems to be looking at the causation.
Well, he was looking at the causation. I'm saying that Judge Hellerstein didn't make a finding independent of causation that Ms. Pastilli is disabled. He clearly made a finding that she testified that she was complaining of symptoms that would interfere with her ability to perform the duties of an attorney, but the objective evidence doesn't support the severity of those symptoms, which is a pretty common type of finding in these disability cases where you're dealing with subjective evidence and where this court has said that plan administrators and presumably district courts can give weight to objective evidence that symptoms are not disabled. So it's a minor point, but I do take issue with the notion that Judge Hellerstein found that she was disabled. If I may turn to the Krizek case, Krizek merely held that a district court can't rely on evidence that it has excluded in making its determination. So in Krizek, it was an ERISA disability case. The district court held that the evidence would be limited to the administrative record, nonetheless let the plaintiff testify, and then based its decision in part on the court's observations of the plaintiff's testimony. Here, it's entirely different. Judge Hellerstein found that there was good cause to allow plaintiff to testify and referred to his observations of plaintiff's testimony as part of his findings of fact and conclusions of law. There's nothing in Krizek which says that a district court loses all ability to make observations of a testifying witness when those observations may have some bearing on a disability finding. So Krizek is not applicable here. McCauley is a 2008 case superseded by, there's no question that McCauley said, hey, First Unum, based on things that happened in the 1990s, so 30 years ago, had some issues that resulted in a regulatory settlement agreement, which, by the way, all of the insurance departments have said cured those problems. Subsequent to McCauley, this court has held that the conflict factor, the structural conflict, an insurance company is deciding claims and paying benefits, merits no weight unless there's evidence that the conflict actually affected the claim determination. So there's no obligation for the court to expressly address the conflict factor. And I don't believe it was raised in that way in the court below. It was raised as a question of violation of the regs, that the doctors were biased. And Judge Hellerstein correctly found, supported by the evidence, that the doctors' reviews were careful, they were extensive, and that he didn't accept the notion that they were going to abandon their ethical obligations simply to give some minor financial benefit to First Unum.
Can you address for me the issue of the standard of review that we should apply? Because you spent a lot of time in your brief sort of mentioning that Judge Hellerstein at the end of his opinion says he applies arbitrary and capricious and then says, but even if I were to apply de novo review, I would still make a finding that the plaintiff or appellant in this case has not met her burden of proof beyond a preponderance of the evidence.
Sure. Yes, we did raise the de novo argument first because if the court accepts and confirms Judge Hellerstein's finding that he would confirm on de novo review, then it's unnecessary to reach the question of what the standard of review should, whether it should be an arbitrary and capricious standard of review. But I do believe the arbitrary and capricious standard of review applies here. There's no question the plan provides discretionary authority to First Unum. And the focusing on the timeliness issue, which is the most substantive issue that plaintiff raises, there's no question that First Unum made its determination within the 90 days allotted, assuming it properly extended the appeal timeline. First Unum said there were special circumstances because A, it had requested the psychiatric records from plaintiff. It was waiting for plaintiff to advise whether it was she was going to submit those records, and that once it understood the totality of the medical evidence that plaintiff was going to be relying on, it was going to have peer reviews done. Now, plaintiff really can't.
So what's your position on the argument your adversary raised that those documents were irrelevant?
They weren't irrelevant, Your Honor. They were asked for before the claim was denied, and in the decision on administrative. When First Unum asked for those records, it specifically said to plaintiff's attorney, look, we're looking at a whole person here. The psychiatric records may impact our review. We think they would be helpful for us to review. We want to give you an opportunity to submit them. And then it waited a couple of weeks for plaintiff's attorney to respond, we're not going to submit those records.
That I understand what they were relevant to. I gather First Unum did submit, I gather that Ms. Pastilli did submit psychological records. Is that right?
Neuropsychological records.
Neuropsychological records.
Which are sort of like formal objective tests rather than psychotropic medication, talk therapy, things like that.
Were the psychiatric records relevant to assessing the neuropsychological records?
If I may, Your Honor, I can quote from the decision on administrative appeal. This is on page 2763 of the record. There's a couple of paragraphs, but it says, quote, your client is also noted to have a history of behavioral health symptoms, including panic attacks, anxiety, and depression, for which she was prescribed medication and received treatment from a psychiatrist, Dr. Hammerman, and possibly a psychologist. We were not provided with those records despite inquiring about them on appeal. And then it goes on to give a paragraph explaining that, you know, those records may indicate that there's a pre-existing condition. They may be relevant to the determination, and First Unum was reserving its rights to address that issue in the event that it became necessary. So First Unum addressed the absence of the psychiatric records in its appeal decision. I do want to address the Holmes issue. So this court has not spoken on how special circumstances is determined. I do think the court should adopt the finding of Holmes and at least part of the finding of Cogdell, the Fourth Circuit decision, that says the question whether special circumstances exist is something that's within the discretion of the plan administrator. That is not contrary to McCauley. There's nothing inconsistent with saying plan has to strictly comply with the regulations, and one part of the regulations say that the claim administrator has discretion to determine whether special circumstances exist. District courts and this court all the time weigh this discretionary evaluation in much more complicated situations. Was it arbitrary and capricious for the claim fiduciary to determine that the plaintiff was not disabled? That's an arbitrary and capricious review. There's nothing that's impossible or difficult for the district court to evaluate whether the claim fiduciary acted within its discretion in deciding the special circumstances.
And are the reasons you're saying that discretion was reasonably exercised is because the voluminous new documents and waiting to see whether she was going to provide the psychiatric records.
Correct.
Anything else?
They had asked for Social Security information, and plaintiff didn't respond to that, but that wasn't addressed in the extension
letter. On the voluminous records part, at what point in the first 45-day cycle did you get those records?
Well, it got a bunch
you
of the,
have them right at the start? Did you get them in the middle? How did that work?
So most of the records were submitted right at the start. About 2 weeks after those several hundred pages of records were submitted, First Unum contacted plaintiff, I think it was January 9th, contacted plaintiff and said, there seems to be something missing. I think there was a page or two of one of the statements missing, and then plaintiff provided it. So it was really, I think the appeal was December 23rd, and that last submission was January 9th. So, but our view is even if you start the clock running on December 23rd, everything was timely. If I can just return to the discretionary issue on special circumstances, I would urge the court, if it wants to reach this issue, to reach it in that way, because that way you're not imposing some one-size-fits-all rule in a very complicated claim scenario. I think that you're allowing the district courts to evaluate the totality of the circumstances surrounding the extension and determining whether it was reasonable. So as Judge Hellerstein said, First Unum was trying to do a detailed job here. It had it could have simply denied the claim right away, but it wanted to do an extensive review. Or like Salisbury held, that if there's a circumstance beyond the control of the plan, that would be special circumstances. This court doesn't know all the scenarios that might arise that might require an extension of time. And by allowing there to be discretionary review of that decision, the court is giving the district courts the flexibility to look at the record, to consider the circumstances and decide.
Well, would the district court review to see whether the decision to take more than 45 days was arbitrary and capricious? Would that be the standard of the district court's review?
Yes, if this court adopts the Holmes and the Cogdell standard.
Which is what you're urging.
Correct, yes. Then.
So what you're saying is we should say that the arbitrator has discretion to decide it needs more than 45 days for special circumstances. The district court, in reviewing whether it was really presented with special circumstances, would only review for arbitrary and capriciousness.
Correct.
Okay, I wanted to be sure I understood.
Correct. And that allows the district court to address issues where, as my colleague says, if a delay is simply to run out the clock, I don't know why any insurance company would want to simply delay decision for the sake of delaying decision. But assuming for a moment that one ascribes evil motives to insurance companies, if a district court finds there was no reason for a delay here, you simply, people went on vacation or people didn't bother dealing with this for 45 days, that's not a special circumstance. The district court can hold your extension was not reasonable. You abused your discretion in extending the time. And that avoids, if the court says, and it's the reason I disagree with the ultimate holding in Cogdell. Cogdell said, it can't be a special circumstance if it's something that has to occur in every claim. But when you look at the regulation, the only example the regulation gives is it's a special circumstance if you need to hold a hearing because the plan requires a hearing. By definition, that's something that would occur in every appeal because the plan requires a hearing. So it can't be that its own special circumstances has to be something that doesn't routinely occur. And I think as Judge Hellerstein recognized, there can be complicated scenarios, and I think this court should empower the district courts to have the flexibility to look at the facts and determine whether special circumstances exist rather than imposing some firm rule and say it has to be this to be special circumstances and it can't be anything else. Unless there is any other questions, I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And for the record, you've got close to 8 minutes, so I think it's fairly even. Thank you. Attorney Dubofsky, did I pronounce that correctly?
You did. Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
I doubt I'll need all of it. Just a couple of points. With respect to the Holmes case, as I pointed out in my opening argument, that standard would undermine the regulations. This should not be a matter of discretion. It should be a matter of strictly complying with the regulations as the regulations require. With respect to the Kreiser case, with all due respect to—
But strict compliance, and I'm not suggesting that's the case here, that would invite potentially, because it's a two-way street, that could invite a party to not provide records and have the administrator miss the deadline. So how do we deal with that?
Well,
I'm not suggesting that happened here, but...
In your Honor's hypothetical situation, if that happened, that would be a special circumstance. But all of the evidence was presented to Unum on day one. The only thing that was missing was one page of a witness statement. That's it. All the medical records were there on day one of the appeal.
Well, again, to just push the hypothetical a little bit or push the argument a little bit, if the record that resulted in the original denial was 25 pages, and in support of the appeal, 25,000 pages were submitted, we would have a different argument on there being an extraordinary circumstance to review that much material, right?
We would. And
okay.
You know, reason,
so is the argument that the quantity and content of these records just don't support an argument that you need more than 45 days?
Correct. There was nothing unusual about this appeal.
Now, but that argument is made in the first instance to the district court, and the district court says, no, I find it was diligent, to that it was, in order to conduct a diligent review, it was reasonable for them to want more than 45 days. What do we do with that?
And that's why I started my presentation with HALO, that the court did not follow the HALO decision when the court made that decision. All right, I see my time is up, and the court has indulged me more than what I expected, so I appreciate it, and I ask the court to reverse the court below.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. Well argued. We will take the case. We will reserve decision on the case. Thank you.